Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. My name is Andreas, and you are listening to Volume 3 of the AWS To Go series. Get started with AWS or broaden your knowledge while walking, biking, running, driving, or whenever you enjoy listening to podcasts. There are three things I want to highlight before we get started. First, the AWS To Go series is based on our book, Amazon Web Services in Action, published by Manning. And we are currently in the progress of writing the third edition. Most of the chapters, the manuscript has been handed over to the publisher, so you are able to read most of the chapters already online, and the printed book will follow within the next few months. So check out the show notes for details. Second, AWS expertise is in high demand. For example, our partner TechRacer is looking for a cloud consultant with a focus on AWS serverless development. TechRacer is a premier AWS consulting partner with branches in Germany, Austria, Portugal, and Switzerland. And to become a cloud consultant with focus on serverless development, you should be interested in serverless, Lambda, Python, Node.js, or Go as the programming languages. And actually, build really cool stuff based on those serverless technologies. And our other partner is Demicon. And Demicon is an advanced consulting partner based in Germany, and they are looking for cloud solution architects with a focus on AWS. So the skill set that you need to have there is GitLab, Terraform, or infrastructure as code in general, Kubernetes, EKS, Lambda, Python, maybe Go. So that's your skill set there to build cloud solutions. You will find links to the open job descriptions in the show notes as well. And third, I want to welcome Stefan to the show. Stefan is a web and front-end developer, and he just gets started with all things AWS. And that is why I'm inviting him to this show, where we really dive into AWS step by step, and getting him to this journey. And he's here basically to also ask all the questions that beginners have. So Stefan, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Andreas. Thanks for the invitation again.
Yeah, it's the third time, Stefan. Nice to have you again.
Yeah.
So let's get started. So the topic for today is Elastic Compute Cloud, probably better known as EC2. And in case you want to follow along, check out chapter 3 of our book, AWS in Action. Okay, so let's get started. So I would say EC2 is one of the most fundamental services of AWS, because, in other words, EC2 is about starting a virtual machine in the cloud. So that's something we have been probably doing for quite some time before AWS was around as well. So a virtual machine, to start that in a data center and being able to control that, run your server stuff there. And that's basically what EC2 is about. Of course, there are a lot of details about EC2 as well that we will dive into during this episode. But overall, yeah, it's about launching a virtual machine. And Stefan, did you launch an EC2 instance? That's basically the name for a virtual machine on AWS already.
Never.
Okay. So never. That's perfect. So let me walk you through the progress. So what's needed to launch an EC2 instance on AWS? Okay. So of course you need an AWS account, all of that. We discussed that in the previous episodes already. But as soon as you're logged into the AWS Management Console, for example, there are three steps that you need to go through. The first step is you need to choose basically the starting point. You're choosing the image of the virtual appliance that you're going to launch. AWS calls this image an Amazon machine image. Of course, they have their own name for everything. Yeah, and that's AMI. That's the short form. And the first thing you do is you select one of the available Amazon machine images. There's basically, you can think of it like a huge catalog of machine images available. Probably the most popular that I use typically is Amazon Linux. So they have their own Linux distribution. And you can launch that, or Windows. There's Windows machine images available as well. or other, I don't know, a Red Hat, or I don't know, whatever you can think of, basically a Debian, what have you. And you choose one of those images. And by the way, not only AWS provides those AMIs, also third parties mm-hmm. can do so. So for example, we do so when we sell our Bucket AV virus scan for S3 buckets. We build an AMI and sell that through a so-called marketplace as well. So yeah, there are a lot of AMIs out there. And you can also build your own. Then those are private ones that no one else can access. So yeah, but that's the thing you start with. That's basically the image. So the image, the most important stuff in there is basically a snapshot of a volume that contains the operating system, at least, and maybe even more stuff, libraries, maybe even the whole application that you want to run installed on that. So that's the first thing. So let's assume you're choosing just the default, which is Amazon Linux. And then the next question that you get asked when you follow through the wizard in the management console is about the instance type. So I haven't counted them, but nowadays there are probably hundreds of different instance types available. The instance type basically defines the compute resources that AWS assigns to your virtual machine. So the number of virtual CPU cores, the memory, and then there are a lot of detailed attributes that are dependent on the instance type as well. So stuff like disks that are attached to the hardware where your virtual machine runs, or specific, for example, graphic cards that are available to the virtual machine. Really, a lot of different stuff. But in general, you are choosing the number of CPUs and the memory for your machine that you want to launch. Okay, so that's basically the instance type that you choose. So they have funny names. So for example, let's say M5.large. M5, in this case, is the so-called instance family. And then you have basically in t-shirt sizes, you have a small, large, medium, x-large, 2x-large, and so on. And basically, the idea here is by increasing the instance size, so for example, from M5-large to M5x-large, you're doubling, usually, your CPU and memory capacity. Mm-hmm. And also, typically, the price doubles as well. So, which means you get you can increase CPU and memory by two times, but also the price doubles. And that means also the other way around, you can, instead of having one big machine, you can have two smaller ones and basically pay the same amount of money for it. That's quite interesting. Okay, so that's the instance type. And then the next step in the wizard is the complicated one, because then AWS asks you a lot of details about your virtual machine. So I will give you a few examples. I don't want to talk to all of them now. I think not all of them are that important, but a few I want to highlight. So for example, details that you can now configure is stuff like you can configure the networking configuration for your instance, basically add virtual network adapters to your machine, or you can define the firewall rules for your machine, which is called a security group. You can add an IAM role to your machine to allow the instance to access certain other AWS resources, for example, a lot of stuff like that. So really the details of configuring your virtual machine, for many of those, you can just keep the defaults, but that's available to you for configuration. And then when you hit the launch button, what happens is that in the background, AWS spins up a virtual machine for you. And typically that takes, I would say, a minute or two, something like that is the typical time mm-hmm. for that to happen. And then as soon as the instance is available, you're then able to connect to the machine, and you have really administrator access to the machine, or root access. So you really can change the machine in any way you want to. So you're not restricted. That's not a restricted user or something like that. You have full control over the machine.
As it was my hardware at home.
Exactly. Like you had a server at home or, yeah, exactly. Okay. So that's basically in a very fast going through the details. This is how you launch a virtual machine and the main questions you have to decide on. And then maybe the next thing is, so have you ever connected to a server machine?
No, not really. No.
Okay. So typically when you have to log into a web server or something, you use SSH. Yeah, so that's a protocol that you use to securely establish basically a shell on a remote machine. And that is possible with EC2 instances as well. But that's what I'm not using that anymore. So I have been using that a lot in the past. But nowadays there is, I would say, more modern approach available on AWS, which is also what we are using in AWS in Action in the book. And also everywhere else where we tell others how to connect to EC2 instances, because the problem with SSH, or for Windows machines, it's called RDP, the Remote Desktop Protocol. The problem with that is you need network access to the machine. So typically many developers spin up an EC2 instance with a public IP address, and then they open the port 22 for SSH to be able to connect with the machine. And the issue with that is you don't have an open protocol on the internet that basically everyone can try to use to get access to your machine as well. So you have to make sure you're following best practicing regarding passwords and keys and stuff like that. And another approach is that's really a funny AWS service name. It's called the AWS Systems Manager Session Manager. That's really the name of that feature. So I don't know what they're
smoking. Sounds complicated.
Everyone is making fun of that name, by the way. So I'm not the only one. And the idea behind I just called it Session Manager. Of course, the whole name is just too crazy. And the idea behind that is basically that on the EC2 machine, you have an agent running. And the agent connects to an AWS backend service, the systems manager. And now, when I want to connect to my virtual machine, I do also connect to that AWS service, the systems manager. And basically, my connection gets tunneled through that service to the machine. So the connectivity goes, the EC2 instance establishes a connection with the service, and I am, from my local machine, also establishing a connection to the AWS systems manager. Mm-hmm. And by that, I do not need to open any outbound ports, network ports that are available, because basically the connectivity starts from the EC2 instance and connects to the backend from AWS. And that's really, I would say, from a security perspective, very interesting, because I don't have to deal with all those stuff anymore. And also, as a side effect, I don't need to manage keys or passwords, pass them around with my coworkers and stuff. Instead, I'm using the same authentication mechanism that AWS uses to authenticate a user. So basically, if you have access to log into the management console, AWS management console, you can also get granted access to connect to the machines as well. And that's the same user that you're using. So that's really powerful. That's why we are suggesting to use the AWS Systems Manager, Session Manager, to connect to your EC2 instances.
Mm-hmm. Like this, the Session Manager just reminded me of, like, at least how you explained it. Maybe I misunderstood it, but not a bouncer, but that you're not directly talking to the person who is in charge, but you're just talking to a person, and this person goes then to the person in charge.
That's correct. It's kind of a proxy in between. Yeah, you're correct. Mm. And the funny thing is that, so first of all, in the AWS management console, there is even a web interface for all of that. So you basically can just open a shell on your machine without leaving the browser. That's very cool for quickly jumping on a machine and checking things out. But also, if you really want to, You can integrate that on into your local setup. So I have been doing that. I can link a link to a blog post where I describe how that works. And basically what I do is from my local terminal, I can open, and I really do open SSH connection, but I'm tunneling it basically through the systems manager, session manager. So basically it uses HTTPS under the hood, but I'm tunneling my my SSH session through that. So that's really, maybe it's, for some, it might be even a security nightmare, because if you are a network administrator at a large company, you're typically trying to restrict outbound SSH connections like that. And now I'm just tunneling that over HTTPS and no one knows. But on the other hand, I really think that's a powerful and secure way to connect to your EC2 instances.
Yeah.
Okay. And then as soon as you're logged into your virtual machine, as we talked about, you are now able to, for example, install packages and configure, I don't know, an Apache web server or install any software on the machine. So you have really administrator access to this machine. Okay, so one aspect, as soon as your virtual machine is running, you might need to troubleshoot the machine. So what happens when the machine does no longer respond or stuff like that, or something goes wrong? One thing that is really helpful is it's called CloudWatch. And CloudWatch is a service that basically collects metrics from all other AWS services. And also that's true, for EC2. So when you have a running EC2 instance, metrics like the CPU utilization or the network utilization are getting pushed to CloudWatch, and you're able to watch them there, basically. Or when you go through the management console, they just show up when you select an instance. So that's how you can get a little bit of a feeling for an instance. For example, if you see, I don't know, the CPU utilization is 100% for hours, then probably something is going wrong on that machine, and you might want to investigate what's going on there. So CloudWatch is really helpful for monitoring a machine. And then, Stefan, what's the best thing to solve a problem in IT? So when a machine doesn't work anymore, what do you need to do?
Restart it.
Yes. So, did you turn it off and on again, right? So that's the thing that solves everything. And that's a functionality that you have with EC2 instances as well, of course. So basically, let's quickly talk through the different actions that you can do with a machine. You can start a machine. Starting a machine means you're starting a machine that you stopped before. As you can, anytime you can stop a machine. When you stop a machine, it stays around, basically. So, for example, everything that is stored on disk is still available. You're able to start the machine anytime you want to. When you stop a machine, you're stopping also paying for the machine, because you're only paying for running EC2 instances. So when a machine is stopped, you're not paying for the virtual machine anymore. You're just paying for the used storage. That's another thing. And then, of course, there's rebooting a machine. So when you have a running machine, you can just tell AWS, hey, reboot this virtual machine for me. And that's basically like pressing the reboot button on the machine. It tells the operating system to do a reboot. And the fourth option is, I think it's a little bit misleading, the term. You can also terminate a virtual machine. And terminate, I would say a better word would be delete. Yeah, because that's really deleting the virtual machine. It stops the machine and then it deletes it. And after you terminate a machine, you can no longer start it. So it's just gone, basically. There's an entry in the list of EC2 instances that keeps around for a while so that you know that something was there. But you cannot do anything with that terminated machine anymore. So that's really important concept for beginners, because so often I see people struggling with the difference between stopping a machine and terminating a machine. And basically the important difference is terminating means delete, and stopping is you can stop a machine. It's maybe better pause. That's maybe another
term. Yeah, on hold, yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
And you can start it later. Yeah. So So that's maybe important. That's basically the life cycle of an EC2 instance. And one other interesting aspect of EC2 instances is, so we discussed the instance types. So an instance type is, let's say you started a machine with M5 large, which mm-hmm. is a certain amount of CPU, a certain amount of memory. And now you notice, oh, I need a bigger machine here. I don't know. It doesn't work. It's too slow. So the easiest thing is to just buy a bigger machine, right? And it's possible to change the size of a virtual machine with EC2. And basically that works best. So there are a lot of edge cases there. So a rule of thumb, it works best as long as you stay in the same instance family. So for example, you can switch from M5 large to M5X large or the other way around. To do so, however, you need to quickly stop your machine, change the instance type, and then start the machine again. So there's a short mm-hmm. downtime when you change the instance type, but that's still very helpful.
And changing the family is not possible or is more complicated?
If I remember it correctly, then I'm not 100% sure here, but I think it is possible to change even the instance family, but it's not possible for all instance family combinations. So it's possible okay. for some of them. I think most of the families cannot be changed, actually, with some exceptions. Yeah. So what's also interesting, at least it was for me as a beginner, I can tell you a story. When I was starting with AWS, I launched a virtual machine. I logged into that. I configured some stuff, installed a web server, probably because that's what I mostly do. And then I went to lunch. And when I came back, I logged into the management console again, and the instance was gone. The list of EC2 instances was empty. And I was really scared. Oh no, the work of the whole morning is gone. I don't know, I did something wrong. I don't know, I have no idea what I'm doing with AWS here. What happened is that accidentally, or that's basically happening sometimes, I switched the region in the AWS management console. So basically I switched the location of the data center I'm mm-hmm. operating in or having a look at. And the current list of EC2 instances only shows the instances in a certain region. For example, you can choose Frankfurt or Ireland there. And so that happened to me. Basically, I switched the region, then the list was empty. And after I switched to the region back that I was using in the morning, the instance was, of course, still there. So nothing was happening. But that's a really powerful thing, not only behind EC2, but behind all of the services, is that as a customer, we are able to decide where to launch a virtual machine. So we can select from a long list of data centers all around the world where we want to launch this virtual machine. And the process looks the same, no matter if you launch it in Frankfurt, if you launch it in North Virginia in the US, or I don't know, in Sydney in Australia, right? That's the same thing over and over again. And that's, I think, at least for me, this was a really powerful experience. Well, I can do the exact same thing everywhere around the world in all the data centers that are available. And Stefan, can you think of reasons to choose a data center location? So what would you, so when you have a look at the list of AWS regions, so what do you think, what's the reason to choose one of those regions?
The first thing, obviously, as a web developer, is speed.
Yeah.
So if all of my customers are in the US, then I want to have my website hosted in the US.
Yeah.
So the latency is as...
Yeah. Latency matters. And basically, the longer the line between the server and the client, the higher is the latency. There's no way around that. So that's just physics, right? Absolutely. That's an important one, definitely. Do you have any other ideas? Why would you choose a certain region?
Obviously, also currently hot topic, I would say, is data protection, data security. I guess you want to have servers running in the EU if you are from the EU. So all the data is stored there.
Or the other way around, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, or the other way around. And then obviously, yes, just security. So you want to have to distribute it in different areas. So if one area is completely a failure, then...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there are two important things. So one is you might be basically by law, data protection law, GDPR, what have you, there might be a rule that says you should process your data, I don't know, within the US, within the EU, whatever your country is. And basically by choosing one of the available data centers, you can make sure that the data that you are processing or storing does not leave those data centers in that specific region. That's an important thing. So we could call it maybe compliance. And the other is what you're describing is you are already thinking about something that we are really discussing at the very end of our book. But you're thinking about distributing your workload among multiple data centers to make sure if one data center has an outage, suffers from an outage, another machine can take over, stuff like that. Yeah, that's correct, of course. And then there's maybe a surprising factor for choosing a region for your EC2 instance, and that is costs. Because costs are different in the different regions for the same EC2 instance. So that's, I don't know exactly, of course, but it's probably because of different energy prices in different parts of the world, probably different costs for labor and stuff like that. So yeah, that's just cheaper and more expensive regions. So that's maybe also an aspect, yeah.
That's interesting. Is it, so but the costs are then like for all of the services, it's not like that, let's say CloudWatch is here, it's cheaper, but.
I don't know. I don't think there is a really rule for that. So like, I don't know. There's no rule like there's 10% discount in Ireland compared to Frankfurt or so. There's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So it's really the pricing for the different regions is different for each service. So some services from AWS, you pay the same no matter the region you choose. Others like EC2, for example, you have different prices for different regions. So it's not really, I don't know. I think there's a rule that you can apply to calculate that.
Okay.
So it's just different for each of those services. Yeah, but there are a huge list of services really available. And so I actually, when I free written the chapter for the third edition, I was updating the list of EC2 instances. And then 2 months later, it's already outdated, right? So there are regions, data centers going online, I would say every quarter or something, and they announce the next ones already. So this is really growing fast, and they are basically covering Europe, Asia Pacific, Africa, Middle East, US, of course. So I don't think there's much left on Earth that is not covered by a nearby data center. Yeah. And but that's really powerful. And I have been using for many consulting clients that make use of that, that are really spinning up machines in different data centers worldwide. So that's a really powerful concept.
Based on your experience, is the, like, for the EC2 instance, let's stay in the chapter, are the prices there, the price difference like in a 0.00 cent region, or is it more like, I don't know, 1 cent per hour?
That's a very good
kind of thing.
We can quickly look it up. So I don't know it. So let's quickly check it. So for example, an EC2 instance, let's say M5 large, that's the one, very popular one, that's why I'm talking about that all the time. So this costs about 10 or it's basically 9 9.6 US cents per hour in US East North Virginia, which is probably one of the cheaper regions. So let's compare that. So 9.6 US cents. And let's compare that to Frankfurt, where you pay 11 cents, 11.5 cents for the same instance. So it's a significant, or I would say it's a significant difference.
It is, yes.
compared to what, but yeah, it is a difference, definitely. And yeah, that's why it might be interesting to choose another region for your workload. Of course, actually in real world, most times costs are not the main concern when choosing a region. So for our clients, the most important region is data protection laws and regulations that they have to follow. Sometimes it's also for our German customers, it's more like a feeling. They want to have the data sent in Germany because they feel it's kind of more compliant to GDPR. It's not more compliant than, for example, Ireland, but it just feels better, or maybe. And I think that's oftentimes the most important aspect. And then I think latency is the other important aspect. On the other hand, if you do things like I have heard about, I've never done that myself, but if you're doing spinning up huge clusters for data analytics and stuff like that, it might be worth the effort to transfer your data to another region and then be able to compute on that more cost effective. So that's definitely something that some AWS customers are doing. So I would say it depends a little bit on your on your requirements.
And pricing in general, I guess we never talked about that, but like if I book a service at AWS, let's say it's 10 cents when I book it, how does the price change affect me? Like, is it instantly, like every month, like let's say AWS is increasing the price to 11 cents. Do I have to pay immediately the 11 cents, or do I have to accept it, or how is this working?
Okay, so you're asking about what happens when AWS decides to change the price for a certain service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so far, there were a very, very, very few times when AWS basically hired the prices. I think there are some, it's really in AWS history. I have not really, I was not around the topic, but I think they introduced a different pricing model for S3. I don't know if I remember it correctly someday, because they just had an issue with the current pricing model, which was not covering all the costs in their infrastructure. I think there was some of that. But typically what happens is that they are reducing prices. At least that's what happens so far. I'm a little bit concerned what happens under the current economic situation where we have inflation and prices going up, especially for energy and stuff. So that might be interesting what's happening in the next few months when energy prices rise. And I guess they have contracts, very long running contracts with their energy suppliers, but someday they might run into issues where prices are rising there. So I don't know. I have no idea into that business, but just my feeling. So, but yeah, typically they lowering prices and then they just announce that. And then with the beginning of the next month, those new prices are applied to your AWS bill. That's what it's happening. Yeah. But talking about pricing is another interesting thing. So we could talk about that for hours, especially even for EC2 instances. But maybe so as a rule of thumb, so there are details to everything, but exceptions for everything. But as a rule of thumb, you can say Linux instance on EC2 is built per second. So you're really only paying for the seconds that an EC2 instance is running. The minimum charge is 60 seconds. So if you're stopping a machine after 2 seconds, you're still paying 60 seconds. But after that, it's really for each second that the instance is running. So that is, I would say, very, very fine granular and very interesting. But the pricing model that is behind that, so really paying only during the time where the instance is running, and this is called so-called on-demand instances. So yeah, when you have the need, you spin up the instance, you start or stop the instance whenever you need, and you're only paying during the time span that you have been using the virtual machines. Okay, that's really flexible. Yeah, you're just using the capacity as you have the need for. The downside of that is the price for that is high compared to other options that is available, of course, because you have that flexibility and you also have to pay for that. And then there's another concept to lower your EC2 bill, basically. That's what comes up after some time. After you spin up some instances, you will think about lowering your costs, but it's typically a significant part of your monthly AWS bill. And a way you can reduce your EC2 costs is called savings plans. So what you can do with that, basically, what you do is you commit to a certain usage of EC2. So for example, you say, I will run an M5 large, same example, instance 24/7 for 1 year. And then you commit to using this amount of resources, and you're also paying for that amount of resources, no matter if you use it or not. And basically the other side of the deal is you're getting a discount on the on-demand price. So that's how you can, that's the other pricing model that is available. So you lose flexibility and you get a discount on the on-demand instance price, significant discount. Depends on the details, but you're getting a discount. And the other, there's a third option. This is called spot instances. This is my most favorite a way of paying for EC2 because it's the cheapest one. Spot instances are really cool because basically what you do, so AWS has data centers with lots of machines and they have a lot of spare capacity within those data centers. So just machines that are running where no virtual machines or not, that are not utilized 100%. And with spot instances, you're basically using those spare capacities in the AWS data centers. And you get a discount on the on-demand price of up to, so that's important, up to 90%. So that's really huge discount. But there are some buts here. So first of all, the price for the spot instances is not static. It's a flexible price that changes over time. So when you look into the different data centers worldwide, you see basically like in the stock market, you see the price chart going up and down. It's not as crazy as in the stock market. It grows and shrinks very slowly. But there is there's basically an effect of how much is the demand for the compute capacity and how high is the price. So it's not a real market, so you're not really bidding for stuff and stuff like that, but it's the price is changing based on the amount. Okay, so that's one aspect. But on average, the discount you get is up to 90%. So that's important still. And then there's another thing that you need to be aware of, which is when you start an EC2 instance, a spot instance, AWS has the right to terminate your machine when they need it back. So for example, I am using a spot instance, and now you in your account are launching an on-demand instance, and AWS has no capacity left. So then what AWS can do, it can terminate my spot instance to be able to fulfill your need for an on-demand instance. So that's what happens. So when you run a spot instance, it's possible, it's not very likely, but it's possible that AWS will terminate the instance to be able to have that capacity back for someone else. You get a 2 minutes before AWS terminates your instance, you get notified So your machine can handle that notification if you want to. But that's the thing. So what are scenarios where it makes sense to use an instance that might be terminated within 2 minutes after notice?
That would have been my question, yes. Yeah.
So can you give you a very good... So I'm coming back to the same example. So Bucket AV, our solution to scan S3 buckets for malware. Mm-hmm. This is basically an asynchronous process. So you upload a new object to S3, and then in the background, our solution starts to download the file, check it for malware, and then send back a result. Yeah. So in that scenario, with an asynchronous workload, or we might also call it batch processing or something like that, it doesn't really matter if the machine gets terminated as long as you keep track of the jobs that you need to run. You can just repeat the same thing again on another machine in case one of the machine gets terminated. And that's why we are using spot instances for Bucket AV by default, because yeah, it's really cheap. The infrastructure for the virtual machine is really cheap compared to the others. And it doesn't really matter to rerun a job because the instance has been terminated. And there's a website from AWS, even where they have basically, they analyze the data from the past and they tell you how likely is it that a spot instance of a certain instance type in a certain data center gets interrupted by such a termination. Yeah. And it's typically very unlikely, but it depends a little bit between the instance types and the regions.
Okay, so I guess if I can wrap this up, on-demand instance is basically I, as a customer, have the full safety and control, mm-hmm. Because I can terminate it whenever I want. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I have to pay for that, flexibility. Mm-hmm. Saving plans is basically I get the discount and AWS has the safety security that this instance is taken for the time period mm-hmm. I am having the saving plan for. And spot instances is basically me walking into the bakery before it's closing and asking for the last bread and they are like, okay, here it is.
Exactly. So it's a huge bakery. They have a lot of bread.
Yes.
Yes. It's possible that it's running out of bread or instances.
Yeah. Actually, not every day there's a bread left.
Yeah, totally. And maybe one important aspect about the savings plans is that with savings plans, you can decide whether you want to pay for the 1 or 3 year term upfront or not. So you can really pay your whole machine 3 years in advance, which of course mm-hmm. gives you the highest discount, or you can decide to pay only half of it 1 year in advance, or you don't have to pay anything upfront. You're just committing to do so. That's also possible. But that's also an interesting financial instrument. So for some companies, it's very interesting to have huge costs this year and no costs next year for some reasons. Yeah, you know those budget stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's another thing you can do with savings plans. Okay. So that's about costs. So I think the thing I really like most is the spot instances. It's really a powerful tool. And I don't think you... So there are not many... So this is not an option you have in your on-premises world or in a hybrid or private cloud environment. So this is really something you're getting at those huge cloud providers with a lot of capacity. There you have those options. And this is really powerful, also cost-wise. Okay, Stefan, so we talked about a lot of the details of the EC2 service. So the service that allows you to spin up virtual machines on AWS. I hope you enjoyed all the details about pricing and stuff. You ran into those rabbit holes a little bit.
As always.
I think it's a powerful service. It's really the basic service. One of the basic services on AWS is EC2. And you can do a lot of things with it. I'm using it, I would say daily probably, yeah, because I'm running some workloads or starting a machine quickly there. It's really powerful. Sometimes I'm using even it for personal stuff. So I'm sometimes using it to spin up a virtual machine as a VPN server somewhere in the world, stuff like that. So yeah, you can really do a lot of things with that. Of course, legacy workloads are running on EC2 instances. So when we do lift and shift migrations from on-premises to the cloud, EC2 is the go-to service because you can just replace a virtual machine in the data center with a virtual machine in the cloud. So yeah, it's really an important service. And when you get started with AWS, it's definitely something you should dive into. Okay. So did you learn something new by listening to this podcast episode? May I ask you for a favor? Please tell your friends and coworkers about the Cloud On Out podcast. Also, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Our work at Cloud On Out is possibly only because of your support. Therefore, we want to thank our supporters. With your help, we can continue to produce independent and high-quality content focused on AWS. If you are not already doing so, please consider supporting us with a one-time or recurring donation as well. You will find all the details in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon, Stefan, with another AWS To Go episode.
Hopefully, yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. It was a pleasure. Bye.